I'm here with SpinQuest, where you can play and win from the comfort of your own home with hundreds of slot games and all of the table games you love with real cash prizes. Right now, $30 coin packs are on sale for $10 for new users. It's all at SpinQuest.com. That's SpinQuest.com.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
I'm here with SpinQuest, where you can play and win from the comfort of your own home with hundreds of slot games and all of the table games you love with real cash prizes. Right now, $30 coin packs are on sale for $10 for new users. It's all at SpinQuest.com. That's SpinQuest.com.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
This is Break the Case with Jennifer Coffendaffer. Inside the evidence, behind the headlines, from someone who's been there. Here now, Jennifer Coffendaffer.
True Crimers, welcome to Break the Case. I'm your host. I'm Jen Coffendaffer. Thank you for being with me here this afternoon to talk about Ellen Greenberg. This is our third show we've done on Ellen. I want to just give you a teeny bit of background of how I even got involved in this case. I'm always perusing different cases every day to try to find different cases that just catch my eye, something that just seems completely unjust or something that's controversial. Oftentimes people send me cases. In this case, I found this case and I posted on it. Now, I'm going to give you a lot of background regarding the particular case, but specifically I posted on this probably 3 years ago, 2 to 3 years ago on Twitter, X. And immediately News Nation, Chris Cuomo, his producers, who obviously I work with, they reached out and they said, listen, we want to do a show on Ellen Greenberg. They were really the first ones to reignite this case back into mainstream media. They were amazing. They ended up having both the Greenberg parents on, which was great. And after I did that post, I ended up hearing from Dr. Greenberg and his wife, Ellen's parents. And, you know, we just started a relationship, if you will, particularly Sandy, obviously, because, you know, we have a lot in common. We have a beautiful daughter. I was very interested in this case. And obviously, for, you know, she was very interested in this case and in justice. And when they first contacted me, I was so fortunate because, like a lot of the individuals who contact me that are family, they have so much more information than anybody can get in the public. So that's what they did. They sent me the autopsy, all the reports, anything I requested. They were great. So I could really take a deep dive. Initially, like many of you, when you see the photograph, and there's many of these, I just pulled up this one, of these stab wounds. And this only denotes 20, by the way, because of the new report we just found out, there's 23 stab wounds, but I'll get into that. But when I first saw and understood how she was stabbed, it did not make any sense from my background. It didn't make any sense from all the individuals who have taken their own life. I did a deep dive into how many individuals even use a knife to kill themselves. It's so limited. And of those that are female, it's even more limited. It's a very unusual manner to take your life. As a female, most females either use drugs, they overdose purposefully, or they slit their wrists. That's pretty much the two main manners for women. And a lot of that has to do with maintaining how they look, not wanting to adulterate their beautiful bodies. And in this case, as many of you know, Ellen Greenberg was absolutely stunning. She could walk in a room and just take it by storm. I've spent a lot of hours talking to Sandy and to Dr. Greenberg about their beautiful daughter. They sent me so many photos, unseen photos of her growing up. I did a whole half a segment just on Ellen so people could really understand who she was, what she liked to do, what she was like as a child, as a teen, as somebody in college, the struggles she had, and good and bad, right? And I could tell you most of it was very good. She made good grades. She got a teaching certificate. And she ended up being, for those of you who don't know, and I think I have her photo up here teaching. Oh, shoot. I had to take it down to make room for some other photos. But she ended up being a first grade teacher there in Philadelphia. And yes, it was, you know, anytime you working for the first time in the profession that you've chosen, there are going to be some challenges. And yes, did she have issues, or if we even want to call them issues, did she have struggles with anxiety? Yes. Was she on medication and was she even seeing a doctor? Yes. For about 2 years, as a matter of fact. And but there's a lot of people who seek help whenever they're having issues adjusting to whether it's work or a relationship situation, whatever it might be. So I don't think that she was struggling with anything to do with self-harm. And in fact, there is absolutely no evidence anywhere that she was struggling with anything to do with self-harm. There's no evidence from the fiance. There's no evidence from her family. There's no evidence anywhere. And I think this is a real critical point that typically a medical examiner will review what was on the table in terms of, was that what she was struggling with? Because that's a big difference. Depression and self-loathing and being upset with yourself and feeling like you're worthless. That was not what she was struggling with. She was struggling with just being anxious and anxiety. And we know from the new report that she was on medication. We're going to go over those medications. And but anyway, I want to go back to really the genesis of all of this. How did Ellen Greenberg, when did her death occur? It occurred on January 26, 2011. You could see how long ago that was. It was over a decade, everyone. And the parents have really had to just anguish in this situation that was so mishandled from the beginning. And we're going to talk about this. But essentially, she was found in her apartment. Now, let me give you a little backstory. It was a winter's day. She was home because school had been canceled. This was a terrible, terrible snowstorm. And her fiance, Mr. Sam Goldberg, he was also there with her. Okay. And purportedly she was, you know, working on papers, working in the kitchen. There was no reports to our knowledge of anything being wrong. She was engaged to be married. She'd actually gotten engaged June of 2010. Now, let me tell you how far along this engagement was. This wasn't one of these loosey-gooseys, hey, here's your ring, let's get married when we can work it out. No, no, no. This was much more extensive than that. They had the wedding dress, the venue, invitations. They'd had the big engagement party and to do. And they were completely down the road, ready to tie the knot, ready to be with one another. So I think this is really important because it taught, you know, that shows future, what she was looking forward to. And she was certainly, certainly looking forward to it in my interviews with Sandy and with Dr. Greenberg. That's just, you know, can't be denied. And in fact, they both say that they liked Sam. They didn't have or see a huge problem, particularly with Sam. Their point of view was, listen, if Sam makes her happy, Ellen happy, we're happy with Sam. I think most of us as parents, we feel that way. We just want our kids to be happy, and we entrust them to have the good view, you know, to know that they are dating and involved with somebody who is a good person. And that's the posture that the Greenbergs took, just to let you know. So anyway, here she is. She's home. Sam, we'll just call him Sam. Sam says he's going to go work out. So he purportedly goes to work out. And the next thing we know is that, again, and so much of this is according to Sam, but then also there are phone records and things of that nature that show, essentially, he says he came back to the apartment and there was a clasp lock, let me show you, that was closed on the door. He says, after some period of time, and he makes all these phone calls, he calls her parents, he calls his parents, he calls his uncle, he's making all these phone calls and calling her. And he essentially finally says, okay, I'm going to just break down the door. And he says that what he does here is he breaks down the door and he goes in only to find her, you know, in the kitchen. Now, I say that because we're going to talk a lot about what he really saw. We're going to talk about the 911 call. But I want to focus in on this latch. And this is something from the vantage point of law enforcement, 15 years on the SWAT team. Let me tell you what, when you have a clasp block like this, they're on most hotel rooms. And when they're engaged, they don't just flip off like this. Now, you can make them flip off. You can use everything from, you can set them in there using everything from dental floss. You can use various modes to sort of stage it and then hit the door and then have it clasp. But this is what I want to talk about, is what happens once it's locked. To break into this kind of a lock, you cannot do it just with a shoulder. You can't do it. I mean, a SWAT team to get into something like this, what you're going to see is either the door or the side is going to have to break. There's no other way to get in if it's truly engaged. You can't just bump it and have it come open. And to me, this was one of the first things I saw where I said, no, 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 no. This, in my opinion, was staged. This lock I'm talking about, this particular lock was staged. The force that it would take to open this door, if it was engaged, would not leave this result. You would see the door completely broken. Something has to give. Either that side mechanism with the arm has to give, and what holds it, or the other side has to give. Something has to give, and it didn't. This door would be in shambles. And anybody who might doubt that, I really recommend that you get on YouTube. You know me, I like to try things for myself. You try it yourself. Already been there, done that. But it's going to break. It's going to break that. So this, to me, was one of the first things I saw that I said, wow, this is so staged. I want to go on to, after he gets in, again, there's a huge hiatus in time between him calling 911. And I want to go over really quickly. Hopefully I have it right here. I do. I want to go over what was said on the 911 call that I found particularly objectionable. Look, there's a lot on there that I find objectionable that he said, but let me go over this. And I want to tip my hat to Tuesday Gazette, because Tuesday Gazette is the one that transcribed this. And I appreciate Tuesday for doing this. So you can see it says 911. This is after he comes in and it's crazy when you hear this call. He seems really quite unconcerned, unexcited, very matter of fact. And I don't always give a lot of weight to that because everybody responds to a crisis and to a loved one being hurt in a different way. So I always try to give some deference in understanding that everybody has their own way they deal with this type of a situation. But the coldness that you can hear on that tape is really profound. Let me go over some of the words that are said in particular. This snippet is great, but I want to talk about the snippet in front of there. Basically, and I'm paraphrasing, the 911 call operator asked Sam, you know, what happened? And he provides some bizarre statements, words to the effect of she might have fallen, like he does not know what happened to her. In spite of the fact she had a knife sticking out of her chest, he literally doesn't say that. He talks about, well, I'm not sure. I really don't know what happened. And then later, when they ask him to do CPR, he says, oh my gosh, she's got a knife sticking out of her chest. Well, that would have been normally the first thing you would say when somebody said from 911, what do you think happened to her? You would probably say something like, well, she's got a knife sticking out of her chest. So perhaps, you know, this has something to do with why she's unconscious on the kitchen floor. But this is really interesting what he says. The 911 operator says, quote, are you willing to do CPR with me over the phone until they can? And he cuts her off. I have to, right? And that is about how he says it. It is without emotion and he's irritated. If I had to describe his voice, he's irritated. He says, I have to, right? 911. Okay. So get her flat on her back. Bare her chest, okay? You want to rip her shirt off. Sam says, ah, shit. 911 says, okay, feel down by her side. Sam says, oh, God, Ellie, please. 911, listen, you can't freak out, sir, because you. And then Sam says, okay, I'm trying not to. Her shirt won't come off. It's a zipper. Oh my God, she stabbed herself. Again, it's the bizarrest thing for him to say she stabbed herself. It's bizarre and I didn't want to go over the whole call because the number one thing I want to focus on today is the new ME results. But I feel like these little snippets I'm going to give you are very important for some of the findings that the ME made. And the ME, a lot of people think an ME only looks at the physical situation involved with the woman. In other words, with Ellen, it would only be assessing her physicality, what happened anatomically, as well as the toxicology. But the truth of the matter is, MEs look much deeper than that. They conduct their own mini investigation from what's available. And this 911 call would have been available to her and was available to the ME. Then Sam says, okay, I'm trying again. Her shirt won't come off. It's a zipper. Oh my God. 911, where? Sam, she fell on a knife. Oh no, her knife sticking out. There's a knife sticking out of her heart. This is the actual verbatim transcript. So remember, in the first part of this is so key that he says initially in the 911 call that he doesn't know what happened to her. And then now all of a sudden, because he had to take the shirt off, he notices the knife and says she stabbed herself and then knows she fell on it and all that. It's so ridiculous to believe when you know the size of the knife involved and the fact that she was laying with this knife. And I want to also say, and let me put up this picture. This is the cabinet. I have so many pictures, but this only allows me to do 10. If you could see this, and it doesn't make any sense. There's a clean white towel. You know, you can see the movement, if you will. There's the blood from where it goes straight down, but you can also see the movement on this counter or this cabinetry. The movement always really bothered me in terms of somebody who would be committing suicide. They're committing suicide, but they've stabbed themselves 23 times. By the way, now we know it's 23, not 20. And they're moving all around in this fashion. Nothing makes sense about this crime scene that lines up with somebody taking their life. I want to go into a little bit more about Sam Goldberg. I want to talk about what he was wearing and what he was wearing when he went to work out versus what he was wearing when he was later on scene. This is a snip from News Nation, and Brian Enten was out there. He did some interviews specifically with the first fireman that was on scene. And I think this is a really important interview.
We were able to obtain the surveillance video from the apartment complex where Ellen Greenberg's body was discovered by her fiance, Sam Goldberg. And in the surveillance video, you can see Sam Goldberg going into the elevator after working out when he says he went up and that's when he discovered Ellen's body. And what's interesting in the surveillance video is you can clearly see that Sam Goldberg is wearing shorts, which is also what the security guard in the lobby said to police and also told us when we interviewed him, that he very clearly remembers Sam Goldberg wearing shorts, which you can see in the video. But what's interesting is we have now interviewed the firefighter EMT, who was one of the first on the scene. And he says that he very distinctly remembers Sam Goldberg wearing sweatpants. He remembers it now, he says, clear as day. And he also is quoted in a police report back then, back in 2011, saying Sam Goldberg was wearing sweatpants, not shorts, which is what we see in the surveillance video. Listen to what the EMT told us.
What was he wearing? Do you remember?
I seem to think he was wearing like sweatpants and some kind of a t-shirt. You know, as though he may have been exercising. If you're off, or maybe it's just loungewear for you, but.
And your report from the time said that it was sweatpants.
Right.
Which is interesting because there was another witness who said he was definitely wearing shorts.
Okay.
So I don't know if he may have changed.
Didn't see that happen in front of me. And I don't remember the first responder company lieutenant ever saying that they saw him change.
But if you wrote down sweatpants at the time and you still remember sweatpants.
Right.
I mean, are you pretty confident it wasn't shorts?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. No, I would document everything we found. The thing that you never know is you don't know that from when he found her, quote unquote, found her, did he go in and do anything to the crime scene? We don't know. You know, fingerprints on the door handle. If you watch and you follow what the police do as far as detectives, they look for all of that stuff.
But they didn't do that in this case.
You know? I don't know. I wasn't part of that.
So just another interesting sort of strange tidbit to this whole thing. You know, is it possible that Sam Goldberg changed clothes? Why is it we see him in the shorts in the video, but now we have this EMT who says he's sure that he was wearing sweatpants? We don't know. Sam Goldberg, of course, I should point out, has never been arrested, never been charged with anything, never been investigated from what we know. He's never responded to our request for comment. We know he lives in New York now as a new wife and kids. No one's really commenting besides Ellen's family and attorney and that sort of side of things. On the other side, you know, the attorney general.
All right. I mean, I just wanted to make the point here that essentially there's a lot off in terms of when he found her, the amount of time it took, which was almost an hour and 45 minutes, everyone. For those of you who don't know, an hour and 45 minutes from time of, you know, apparently coming up to that door, and then all these calls, and then entering, and then 911 finally being called. So there's a huge hiatus in time. Again, for those just joining us, because I see a few of these comments, I want to make it clear that Dr. Osborne, right here was his most recent affidavit. He initially found that this was a homicide, a homicide means a killing of another by another. Okay. Then after a meeting with police, a securitist meeting, it was not recorded. There were no notes taken, but he said there was a meeting with police. He changed his mind and he ruled this a suicide. Now, later, much later, very recently, he changed and gave this affidavit saying essentially, so this is just here in January of 25, just saying that no, now it isn't a suicide. It's something other than a suicide. That's what he ended up changing to. So just so everybody knows, it went from with this medical examiner. And remember, Osborne now is clear down in Florida. So Osborne isn't under the thumb, if you will, of anything to do with Pennsylvania. Initially homicide, changed to suicide after some meeting with police, and then changed it back to something other than suicide. So essentially what happened after this, and this was a huge victory for the Greenbergs. This is what they were looking for, as you can imagine, for many reasons. One, they're looking at, you know, a possible death suit, a civil suit against the person they believe is responsible for this. So it's important that the ME have it classified as something other than self-harm. So that was one of the reasons they wanted to set the record straight with what really happened to Ellen, because they felt it was an absolute travesty that it was ever designated a suicide situation. And they always believed it was homicide. Now, I want to say this about these stab wounds. I have literally taken a knife and tried to, you know, not stab myself, but put these knives in this situation. And to have the force to penetrate, like this was penetrated, and the force to penetrate her heart was penetrated. It would take such great force to do this self-inflicted wise, not to mention the huge gash on her head. And we're going to get into that, but you know, you can understand why these parents were so upset just looking physically at this. But this was a huge coup back in January when Osborne changed that designation. So it gave them some leverage to go forward and try to get this case reopened and looked at. Fortunately, a judge finally said, okay, you need to look at it. They just went back to court very recently again because nobody was looking at it, or if they were looking at it, there were no results given. And finally, a judge said, listen, admonished the prosecutors and said, you've got to do something. You can't just keep stringing the Greenbergs along. You need to get something done. So finally, what just came out yesterday was this 30-plus page report, specifically where the new chief medical examiner put forth that, again, this was a suicide, okay? Now, I want to go over why she said this, and this was really what I was looking for. I've always wanted to know, tell us why. Tell us why is this a, you know, a pathological finding? Is this a finding strictly of physicality? Does it have to do with toxicology? What makes you think she took her life? And this is the gold that finally we were given. And I loved it when I saw this. Okay, you're not going to believe all this, okay? Number one, Ellen suffered, she characterizes it as severe anxiety over her first grade teaching job at the time of her death. She was being treated by a psychiatrist for approximately 2 months. And I apologize. I had previously said 2 years, and I believe I'm misspeaking, 2 months. So I want to just make sure. I think I said 2 years earlier. I want to make it clear, 2 months. She was being treated by a psychiatrist for approximately 2 months. There was bottles of aprazolam, clonazepam, and zolpidem prescribed to Ellen. And they were recovered from her bedside table the evening of her death. Okay, come on. A couple of things. First of all, anxiety is so much different than depression that I touched on earlier. But just say she was so anxious that she decided she wanted to take her own life. You have all these bottles of medication that she easily could have taken and had a much less painful, less difficult, less mutilating type of way to take her life. So just the fact they found all that medication on her nightstand absolutely was jaw-dropping to me, that the Emmy decided to characterize this as severe anxiety. To me, when you are severely anxious, you can't get out of bed. People who, what I consider severe of anything, right? They can't work. They can't have relationships. They're in bed. They're just literally, that's what I consider severe, whether it's severe depression, severe anxiety. And so I find it very interesting that this ME has made the leap of saying it was severe. The other thing is she was being treated for it. You know, it'd be different if it was unchecked, if she was having severe anxiety attack of some sort, and she, didn't have any recourse. She didn't have a doctor treating her. She didn't have any medication to get it under control when she was anxious. But she had all of that. Who in their right mind would choose to stab themselves 23 times, desecrate their beautiful body, as opposed to taking an overdose of prescription medication? Okay, so to me, when I looked at paragraph one, I just saw it completely different from how this Emmy decided to describe it. Paragraph two, or number two, her second reason. She has 10 reasons why she ruled this a suicide. That was number one. Basically, she's saying she was anxious, severely anxious over being a first grade teacher. And so that's her number one reason. Her number two reason, while calling the distribution of the 23 stab wounds admittedly unusual, Ellen, and I did this verbatim, Ellen would be capable of self-inflicting all these injuries, even though to the back of her head and neck, even those to the back of her head and neck. That's what she concluded. I wonder if she took a knife and positioned herself to the point of being able to make these injuries. Literally, to be able to hit yourself so hard in the head that you gash your head open. And we're going to talk about one of the wounds that was definitely post-mortem and see what she says about this. You're not going to believe it. So she has the wherewithal to hit herself in the head to cause this gigantic gash, splitting her head wide open. And she's continuing on with all of these stab wounds. So she says it's possibly, or she says it's possible, you know, that, right? She's saying it's possible. That's what this Emmy is saying. I'm saying anything's possible, probable, likely that it happened. I don't agree. I think it's ridiculous. It does not comport with making sense. She also says, this is part of her number two, at least eight shallow stab wounds would be characterized, would be best, she says, would best be characterized as hesitation wounds, an indication of suicide by stabbing. The review identified at least three more of this type of wound, so that would mean 11, upping the total number of stab wounds from 20 to 23. So now the ME says, this ME says, which is different than everyone else who has worked on it, that we not only have 20 stab wounds, now we have 23 stab wounds. She further says that 11 of the 23 are more shallow, which would indicate, you know, hesitation wounds. I know what she's talking about with these hesitation wounds, and certainly some people who commit suicide by using a knife or a blunt object or something can have a hesitation wound. But to make this leap, that what if it's the person who stabbed her is not fully thrusting into her? Is, you know, a knife was changed, by the way, for those of you who don't know it. Two knives were used in this assault. Two knives. Just riddle me this. You're stabbing yourself, hitting yourself over the head, and then you decide to change knives in the middle of that? Or was this more akin to a staging, a situation where you hit somebody over the head from the back, rendering them unconscious, and then you stabbed, and then you stabbed more times to stage this look? In other words, do you do the fatal wounds and then you do these hesitation wounds to make it look, or purported hesitation wounds? You know, I don't know. All I know is this. The scenario I just presented is just as plausible and possible as saying that she did this to herself. I would say the scenario of somebody else doing this to her is much more plausible and probable. Number three reason, Ellen sustained no defensive injuries, which are a telltale sign of being attacked by an assailant. Okay? I'm going to address this right away. First of all, if you get whacked in the back of the head and rendered unconscious, of course you're not going to fight. Look at all of this to her back area. If you're here and you're working on cooking, or you're in your kitchen and somebody stabs you and hits you over the head like this, think of the possibility of being unconscious. You know, bam, stab, 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 stab all those times, and then they fall, and then you finish the business or stab more. It just makes no sense to me that she jumps and leaps to the conclusions that she does. It sounds like a defense attorney. I mean, more than a medical examiner going on the facts. She's not going on the facts. She is jumping to conclusions, I think. You can't say because somebody doesn't have defensive injuries that means that they weren't stabbed to death. I'm going to give you a good example, and that's Ethan Chapin. Ethan Chapin, sun is coming in bright. Ethan Chapin didn't have any defensive injuries. Zanna did. Kaylee did. Maddie did. Ethan didn't have any because he was unconscious. He was totally shocked. He didn't wake up before he was stabbed. If you're blindsided from behind, that would be an explanation for not having those wounds. Okay. Another thing she says, this is all under her number three, the 31 contusions or bruises, contusion, another word, found on Ellen's body aren't consistent with intentional infliction by another. Most of the bruises were healing or in the process of healing. Their distribution is consistent, and listen to this one, you're going to love this, is consistent with incidental contact sustained during activities of daily living including her work as a first grade teacher. Now, I raise your hand if you've had more than 31 bruises on your body. My son plays football. My other son played football for 5 years. He didn't even have 31 bruises that I could see on his body. Certainly my younger one, he gets bruised, and I would say maybe a dozen after a football game. 31 bruises in varying stages of healing. What does that tell you? That tells me when I see somebody who has this sort of bruising, this is an absolute sign of domestic violence that's being hidden, where you're getting hit and then it's healing and you're getting hit again and it's healing and so on. That makes much more sense than just saying, what, she's bumping into a desk as a first grade teacher? She's hitting the chalkboard too hard with her forearm? You know, her grading papers is causing bruises? I am not even kidding you. I know this sounds so farcical. You must just be saying, Jen, are you sure you wrote this down right? This is why I took it verbatim. 31 contusions or bruises found on Ellen's body aren't consistent with intentional infliction by another. How can they say that? But that it's more likely caused by being a first grade teacher. That their words, not mine. Not mine. Anyway, I don't know anyone running around that's a teacher with 31 bruises on their body. As I said before, I don't even know any football players running around with 31 bruises. That's a lot of bruises, everyone. Okay. I move on. Number four, there was no evidence to indicate Ellen was incapacitated or incapable of defending herself, something that would explain the notive lack of defensive wounds. How about the gash in the head? I mean, let's just start with that one. Would that, you know, make you weary to get a gash like this, knifed like this in the back of your head? Would that maybe leave you so you're not able to defend yourself? How about any of these other knife wounds? Wouldn't you just be so stunned? Wouldn't you just be, whoa, what's bam, 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 bam? You know, I've talked about it before in the Idaho case. These stabbings take seconds. You know, just one 1,000, that's one. She has 23 stab wounds. You know. All right. Number five, the DNA of Ellen's live-in fiance, Sam Goldberg, wasn't detected on the knife used to inflict her injuries. Well, first of all, I find two things interesting. First of all, the ME says, the knife. Did you notice that? The knife. There were two knives used in this case, a smaller one and a large one. I should have the pictures up here, but there were two knives used in this case. So did she only look at one? Because she says clearly knife, not knives. She says knife. Secondarily, look at all the time we've just discussed that he's had. Might have had time to change clothes. We went over that with Brian Inton's interview and his piece, right? Did he change clothes? What went on in almost 2 hours? I think it's somewhere between an hour and 45 minutes and 2 hours, so don't want to exaggerate. Let's just say an hour and 45 minutes plus. What went on in all that time, really? Really, what went on? And where else was DNA found? I found it very interesting that she just said it wasn't on the knife used to inflict. Again, there were two knives. Was it on the other knife? Was it on any of the other knives? The one in the chest, his DNA wasn't on it. And yes, yet he was standing over her trying to do CPR, but no DNA on it. Do you see the issues with this? He's admitting he was near that knife. He said he you know, put open her clothes and, or was trying, but she had a zipper and, oh, there's a, he's over her, maybe sweating, maybe a hair would drop, whatever it might be. He's supposed to be doing CPR on her, although I'm not convinced he ever did. He complained about it a lot. My point is that is one of your reasons. Each one of these is so easy to disparage. It's literally like, I feel like this is a defense attorney talking, not a medical examiner. Number six, Goldberg's self-reported timeline of events on the afternoon and evening of Ellen's death is corroborated by phone logs, text messages, surveillance footage, key card swipes, and police interviews. Well, is it? I mean, what do they mean by corroborated? Nobody saw him break in that door. No one. No one saw that happen. They're relying on what he said and his staging of different things, his calls to her, his texts to her. You see, it's such a perfect setup if indeed he is involved in this. What a perfect setup. I'm going to do these texts. I'm going to do these calls. I'm going to do this. But you know what? Nobody's going to be there to watch me supposedly break down the door. That's your broken down door. Do you see if that latch hook is around there? Why that can't work? Next time you're in a hotel room, check out what I'm talking about. Okay. Number seven, there's no evidence Ellen was in an abusive relationship with Goldberg. Okay, I haven't we been over this. How about the 31 bruises in various stages of healing? Did I say 31? Yep, 31. How about the 31 bruises in various stages of healing? How about that? To me, that is a telltale sign of an abusive relationship. But they go on to say a review of their text messages showed the two were often separated due to work and travel. There were no texts where Ellen mentioned hostility or mistreatment, and she never expressed fearing of him, the report states. All right. So let's take that on the face that there were no negative text messages or that she feared him or anything else. Okay, let's just take that on its face. Were there any text messages that she wanted to kill herself? Were there any text messages that she was in such a horrible situation with everything she had going on that she wanted to take her life? Where are those text messages? You notice those weren't mentioned. Nothing is mentioned about issues with that. And you know this ME would have pointed that out. I mean, she's grasping at straws as it is. She's saying, okay, there was nothing showing she feared him. Well, what happens if you're in this huge fight? I should point out too, as I recall, her ring was found on the living room table. I recall Sandy telling me that. Her engagement ring. And that always led me to wonder, did they get in a fight? Did she take off her ring? And did he assault her in a crime of passion situation when she wasn't looking? And then stage all the rest of this. Oh, I'm going to go to the gym. I'm going to, you know, fix that lock and make it look like somebody broke in. I'm going to do some, you know, minor stab wounds with a different knife to make it look like she did this, which still, I don't think it makes it look like she did this, but you know, we don't exactly know. Typically when you see stabbing like this in a heat of passion, there are a lot of wounds because the people just cannot stop. We know in Brian Koberger, 50 on Xana alone, and Kaylee, you know, mutilated. I'm just saying when people are in a frenzy and angry, 23 stab wounds makes some sense. The number wise. Okay. Number eight. The examiner says there was no evidence of a third party being in the apartment on the day of Ellen's death, nor was anyone else's DNA detected on the knife used to stab Ellen to death. Well, I don't know if anybody's saying that some stranger came in here and did this. I don't think anybody logically thinks that happened. I don't know about any of that. I don't think anybody's saying that some stranger off the street came into this apartment and did this. That is not what the facts tend to show in this case. All right, number 9, no findings of a struggle were present at the scene and no valuables were missing. Well, yeah, no valuables were missing because we're not saying that some stranger came in to rob her and did this to her. That's not making any sense. And in fact, you're proving our exact point that there was no struggle at the scene. There's no struggle at the scene because she got whacked on the back of her head and knifed within probably 30 seconds. Probably less than 30 seconds. Takes about a half a second to stab. Let's just give it a second. That's 23 seconds. Bam, 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 bam. She falls. Bam, bam. Also, she was purportedly found up. Look at this. Look at why this. And there were also other marks on this floor. Look at this. She was purportedly found upright, like leaning up against that. Help me make this make sense. In other words, I'm stabbing myself, so I'm going to stand here against the thing. I'm going to, you know, stab myself so viciously, and then I'm going to what? Slump down, and then I'm going to stab myself. Oh, I've got to change knives first. And then I'm going to stab myself in the chest. This just reeks of being staged, in my opinion. It just reeks of it. Okay. Let me move on to the last couple here, or last one, actually. Number 10. The lack of hemorrhage from a wound to Ellen's spinal cord has been cited as a smoking gun indicating homicide, according to the Greenbergs and their team of experts. It indicates Ellen's heart wasn't beating when the cut was made, an impossibility in a suicide stabbing. But the new medical examiner's report dismisses this, concluding the spinal cord wound was most likely an accidental cut that occurred during Ellen's autopsy. This to me is the coup de grace, people. So now, because this medical examiner has to deal with the fact that one of these stab wounds, one of these 23 stab wounds, severed the spinal cord, which would render Ellen dead right then, they've got to explain that away. So what do? They blame Dr. Osborne and say, he cut her. Really? An ME with all of his experience took a scalpel and severed her spinal cord? This is literally what they're saying, because they can't explain that away. See, that's the hard part, because that's where science comes in. And her spinal cord was cut. But they're saying she didn't cut it and wanted, look at these knife wounds where they're at. Right on her spinal column. So they're saying, no, she didn't do that. The pathologist did it. It's absolutely amazing that they have decided to use that as the excuse for the one thing that points to the fact that this was a homicide. All right, I see some really good questions. And that is, this is the big ones from Joseph here, is does the family have any further recourse? No, they really don't. No, they don't. And I haven't called Sandy yet. This came out yesterday. I'm giving her a moment. She usually lets me know everything, whether they're, you know, on TV, whether, you know, they're shooting for a movie, whatever is happening. She's so great. She always lets me know things. And this one she didn't call me about, and I know why. She didn't call me because this is just the biggest blow that they could have imagined. You know, fine if you say you're not going to open, you know, go forward with the case. And I understand why you wouldn't. Look, these people were so much worried about this snowstorm. They got in, they got out of there. They didn't do a proper crime scene evaluation at all. They allowed the uncle of Sam, the fiance, to go in and take all the computers, take her phone, take evidence. And listen, he was a judge. He's an ethics judge. He's a judge that absolutely well knew that you cannot take anything out of a crime scene. And then this is the absolute kicker, everyone. Instead of sealing off that apartment and conducting an appropriate investigation, you know what they did? They released it the next morning to a biohazard cleaning crew. I am not kidding you. The apartment manager wanted to get it cleaned up. She didn't want all that blood and whatever everywhere. So she called and asked the police, hey, is it okay if I have a hazmat? This is a hazmat. This isn't Judy and Cindy's cleaning crew. This is a hazmat cleaning crew. Literally came in, scrubbed everything, got rid of all the evidence. And so the case is ruined. I've always said the case is ruined. The crime scene wasn't properly handled. Nothing from A to Z. As I just told you, evidence was removed by the uncle. You had people in there in the apartment. The responding officers did such a crap job letting these people in the apartment, not documenting, and then releasing her apartment. It's just beyond anything I had ever heard of in a case. So the bottom line is, I get that they're not going to be able to charge. They're not going to be able to charge because of all that. But to say this is a suicide based on those 10 reasons I just went through, it doesn't pass the smell test. It stinks and it's wrong. And I am so sorry, Dr. Greenberg. I'm so sorry, Sandy, that this happened. And I'm so sorry that your absolute beautiful daughter, and I wanted to mention something one more about this. Look at her makeup. Look at her hair. Whatever, I can pull up any picture, and I have dozens of pictures of Ellen. You know what her father told me? And I think this might be on one of the shows we did that I did with the parents. She was methodical about her makeup, about her hair. She's not like me with the hot mess hair. She absolutely had her hair beautiful. He talked about all her lipsticks. He said she just had dozens of lipstick. And it was so critical to her. You know, some people are more, my daughter's the same way. She just looks beautiful to go to the store. You know, she goes through everything she needs to do to have her makeup perfect, her lipstick match her clothes, beautiful clothes that she always wore. This was not a woman that was self-loathing. And for her to mutilate her body, for her to choose that when she had three different high-powered anxiety drugs that she could have taken a bottle of if she really wanted to take her life, and she just left them over there, and she decides instead, no, I think, look at her hair. Oh, I think I'm going to stab myself in the hair, get blood everywhere, stab myself all over the neck and the chest. I don't know, everyone. There's no recourse. I do know that, that I know of at all. They've already gotten independent people, including Sarah Weck, to do the autopsy, to review everything. And he's already said that this wasn't a suicide. So they've already done that. They've paid a lot of money, to try to get this down the road. Yeah, Joseph, I agree with you. But the bottom line is, unfortunately, the Greenbergs are left only to try to make their case on social media, try to make their case on mainstream media, You know, there's, I think, another documentary coming out. I think it's on Dateline. Hulu just had one. But that's all they've got left. So as for us here, we'll just keep her beautiful face and her name and the parents and our thoughts and prayers. And, you know, that ME has to go to bed at night. I don't know what else to say. On my X, I posted all those 10 reasons that they gave, if you want to take a closer look at it. But everyone, I thank you for being here. This is kind of one of these cases that is truly sad. And until next time, all I can say, I can't even say may justice be served, because justice wasn't served and it's not going to be served for Ellen. But hopefully maybe there'll be Ellen's law that comes into play that, you know, readjusts what police have to do in cases like this. I don't know. I mean, those people should be put on leave, if not fired, for how they handled this case. But nevertheless, thank you all for being here. And until next time, may justice be served for anyone else this happens to.
Want to break the case with Jennifer Coffendaffer even more? Then press subscribe right now and join Jen on YouTube. Just search Break the Case with Jennifer Coffendaffer now.
Forget everything you had planned for this weekend, because you are sitting on your couch and winning from the comfort of your own home. I'm here with SpinQuest, where you can play hundreds of slot games, all of the table games you love, and you could even win real cash prizes. New users, $30 coin packs are on sale for $10 at SpinQuest.com.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
Forget whatever plans you have this weekend, because you're staying at home and playing on SpinQuest. And there's never been a better time to sign up than right now. New users get $30 coin packs for just $10. All the table games you love, with hundreds of slot games and real cash prizes. That's at SpinQuest.com. SpinQuest.com.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
Forget everything you had planned for this weekend, because you are sitting on your couch and winning from the comfort of your own home. I'm here with SpinQuest, where you can play hundreds of slot games, all of the table games you love, and you could even win real cash prizes. New users, $30 coin packs are on sale for $10 at SpinQuest.com.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
I'm here with SpinQuest, where you can play and win from the comfort of your own home with hundreds of slot games and all of the table games you love with real cash prizes. Right now, $30 coin packs are on sale for $10 for new users. It's all at SpinQuest.com. That's SpinQuest.com.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
I'm here with SpinQuest, where you can play and win from the comfort of your own home with hundreds of slot games and all of the table games you love with real cash prizes. Right now, $30 coin packs are on sale for $10 for new users. It's all at SpinQuest.com. That's SpinQuest.com.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
I'm here with SpinQuest, where you can play and win from the comfort of your own home with hundreds of slot games and all of the table games you love with real cash prizes. Right now, $30 coin packs are on sale for $10 for new users. It's all at SpinQuest.com. That's SpinQuest.com.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
I'm here with SpinQuest, where you can play and win from the comfort of your own home with hundreds of slot games and all of the table games you love with real cash prizes. Right now, $30 coin packs are on sale for $10 for new users. It's all at spinquest.com. That's SPINQUEST.com.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit spinquest.com for more details.